The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
I'm prepared to do anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then.
Country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should it be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Now, you're very welcome along to this evening's football show. We are busy tonight and we're going to start with a very familiar voice and face. I'm delighted to say the man who you'll know from Five Live, from Match of the Day 2, from the NFL coverage, the excellent NFL coverage on BBC as well, from The Athletic, and probably by the looks of things, 15 other jobs I'm not counting as well. Mark Chapman, it's great to have you on.
You suggest that I basically just tart myself out to any employer that will have me.
They are your words. I would never.
Yeah.
So look, usually I think we've always said, geez, we should try and get Mark Chapman on because given Match of the Day, you're a very familiar face and voice to us over here. But in the main, you're also a pretty busy man until now, I reckon.
Well, and often, I think, have you not often tried to get me on a Monday when we are probably direct rivals or direct competition with the Monday Night Club? So it's always been slightly difficult to talk to you guys. Kevin Kilbane would often say they'd love to talk to you. And it's like, well, we're on air at the same time on a Monday, so it makes it slightly more difficult. But fortunately or unfortunately, because of the current circumstances, we've managed to make it work.
Has your workload kind of grinded to something of a halt, or what are you doing at the moment?
The only thing that's ground to a halt is Match of the Day 2, really. But virtually everything else has stayed not as is, but there is still sort of material that we can use and work with and people that we can talk to. And I'm sure you're finding the same thing, really. Radio in particular has been very, very good at adapting to what is going on. And just like we're having this conversation now on Zoom, it's actually, in a bizarre way, opened up a whole new range of possibilities that probably a lot of us weren't expecting.
Have you found it odd, disconcerting, strange to be talking about matters football in the midst of all this? Are you talking lots about COVID-19 as well? What kind of stuff are you talking about?
No, I think... virtually every show that I do, you sort of find that balance between saying, look, there's more important things going on in the world, obviously, but we will talk about how COVID-19 is affecting the sport world, but we will also try and provide some entertainment at the same time. And I think for the majority of people who've been listening, certainly on the feedback I've been getting, but also my own personal view is you can be worried about the situation. You can worry, be worried that, my mum and dad in their 70s, I can, make sure that they aren't going out and they do self-isolate in the same way that we are doing here, actually. But that doesn't mean that is my only focus of attention. I still want to watch the test on Amazon or some nostalgic football or NFL programs or whatever it may be. I think, as long as you recognize that your audience have the capacity to think about more than one thing at once, you can find the right tone and the right programming.
So you've been doing this being media for a very long time, and I make it you're at Five Live about 10 years. Match of the Day since 2013, Match of the Day 2, that is obviously. NFL show since 2015. All it seems going incredibly well. And that's a nice amount of time at each, in that there's probably still a freshness and an enjoyment to them. But you must feel a sense of ownership and comfort as well. I mean, nothing is as nice, I'm sure, as it looks from afar, but you look to have a hell of a career going.
I don't think I ever signed for more than a 3-year deal at any one time. And you're always conscious that, this industry can very quickly, with a change of management or a change of direction or a change of one person, can quickly go in a very different direction, depending on whether people want you or not. So you always find, I think there's a part of you that stays on edge on edge, I would say, to make sure that you can still earn another contract at the end of the current one. But I think what feels nice at the moment is I can I can be very comfortable being myself on air. And I always think that's really interesting. I've said this a few times to students and various other interviews that being yourself on air is not very easy when you start out, because people are looking for you to fail or trip up or not like you or whatever it may be. Only once you've done it for a period of time and have that confidence in your own abilities and hopefully have enough people back you, whether that be watching or listening or your bosses, then you can relax a little bit and let more of you come into it. I mean, I think if you were to go back, not that I've any reason why you would do this, but if you were to watch the first 2 years of Match of the Day 2, they'd be very different to what they are now. If you were to watch the first 18 months of the NFL show, they'd be very different to what they are now for a variety of reasons, partly because I grow into it and become more and more relaxed, and partly your relationship with all your pundits and your guests becomes different as well.
Yeah, and that latter point, that's a lovely spot when you start to hit that and the chemistry is good and you trust each other. But I think it's totally understandable, especially if you're talking about a show the size of Match of the Day 2, to not try to be the coolest kid in class on your first show. Like, there's an element of saying, look, I'm going to be completely inoffensive here at the start and respect this thing which is bigger than me. It couldn't be the Mark Chapman show to start with.
No. And I still don't want it to be the Mark Chapman show. And in fact, I don't want anything that I do to be the Mark Chapman show, really, because, you know, my view of a sports presenter is always to get the best out of the people that you're working with and the best out of your pundits, whether that be, you know, OC and Jason or Ian and Alan or Tuffers and Vaughan or whoever it may be. You know, that's our rugby league team and Brian Noble and John Wilkin. That's the whole point of it as a sports presenter, is to get the best out of your pundits, both educationally, informatively, and also to hopefully relax them enough to know that they can have some fun with it as well. Because, you know, blimey, it's sport. It's meant to be fun.
Yeah. We had Mark Lawrenson on recently, and he was chatting about various people he's worked with, and he was very interesting on John Motson, who he said was a nightmare before kickoff. I mean, unapproachable. So some combustible mix of nerves and stress, and I'm in my own zone here. And, you know, Lawrenson was saying 10 minutes before kickoff was about when he went up to the gantry. So how are you? Because it's pressure. It's there are nerves for sure. There's spotlight. Once you come on, you're incredibly relaxed and at home and yourself. But sometimes the process to get there is not always straightforward behind the scenes.
No, it's not. But I suppose there are a couple of times when I probably feel at my most, not necessarily nervous, but I suppose full of concentration and taking myself off a little bit to make sure that I get it right. One is the FA Cup draws, because they are just... certainly the early rounds when you go out to a non-league club in the ninth tier, and when you do the first round, you've probably got about 12 or 15 people to interview pre-draw, post-draw. It's a long draw as well. That takes quite a long time for me to get my head around, and there are lots of and it's brilliant, and there's so much excitement and so much pride at all these clubs that the FA Cup draw rolls into town, which is all great. And you want to meet people and talk to people, have a chat with people. But also you need to give yourself 15 minutes just to get your head around it before you actually go on air. So I always find those are probably the ones where I'm most on edge and coiled and ready to go. And then the other ones are the ones where if something very serious has happened, if there's been a death, if there's been a serious story, serious accident, whatever it may be, serious injury, I want to make sure always with that every word and every ounce of the whole show captures the right mood for that moment, so that the tone is right, the guests are comfortable if they've got to say anything of it, and they're the ones where, you know, that because you only get one shot at it, because Match of the Day 2 is live. Everything's live that I do, really, I think. Apart from NFL, that isn't live, but Match of the Day 2 and all the radio, obviously. You don't want to get it wrong and disrespect the memory of someone. So they're kind of the two areas where I might go a bit motty, if you use Laura's analogy.
Where are you on the spectrum then of watching yourself back and self-criticism? Hmm. Do you do all that?
I don't watch myself back, and because I just don't like doing it. It makes me feel really uncomfortable. I've never liked it. I've never liked watching myself back or listening back. I have very honest conversations with people I work with the pundits, with my family, to make sure that we're doing things. And social media can be actually quite a good barometer if you wade through some of the just generally abusive stuff. But just to make sure you're on the right track. You know, after a Match of the Day 2, there is various debriefs over the course of 24 hours to make sure what went right, what didn't go right, where we could improve. So I don't watch myself back just because I don't like it. Hmm.
It's probably been a while since you've had it, but you, in terms of feedback, i.e. Mark, you need to stop doing X, Y, or Z, or you need to start doing A, B, and C. What were some of the things that you might have gotten a debrief, for instance? Does anything jump to mind? The criticism tends to linger.
Oh my God. I mean, you know, how you sit is a big one. You know, whether you sit too far back, whether you lean too far in. I mean, I still get that. I was doing a charity dinner not that long ago, and this bloke came and sat down next to me at the table, and for 20 minutes told me that I was sitting too far back. And if I sit too far back on Match of the Day 2 and lean, I'm not showing respect to the pundit. I'm thinking, well, sometimes you're told to sit back so you're not in the camera shot of the pundit and so on and so forth. But you do, and there are times when I go through a spell and think, my God, I think I've used that word every show that I've done for the past, I don't know, 3 months. So I've got to stop saying whatever that word may be. Or if you do a word, actually, that, you know, quite often someone will point it out to you, saying, look, you're saying, you know, interestingly too much, or listen, or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So the feedback still comes, definitely.
Yeah. You're a radio geek, I'm right in saying, aren't you? From a long way back as a kid, this was your thing.
Yeah. Well, here's another way to say. I always thought it was about 13, and then whenever I say 13, because the fact is, I started listening to Simon Mayo on Breakfast on Radio 1, and I always say 13, and then I've noticed people have picked out, well, you couldn't have been 13 because Mayo wasn't on Breakfast when you were 13, so you'd have to be a bit older. So maybe it was 14 or 15, I don't know. But from that time of listening to Mayo, and here in Manchester, we had a Piccadilly Radio, which is a very strong Manchester radio station back then, with people like Steve Penk on it, who was huge in the Northwest, huge at Breakfast then, and on to Pete Mitchell, who sadly died recently, and lots of great Northwest presenters. Chris Evans was on Piccadilly Radio back in the day. So from my mid teenage years, let's say, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be on Radio One. Yeah.
Because I read, I was going to say a fantastic story. It's more a poignant one, really, of the Bruno Tyson fight when you were a teenager.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was, it was February the 25th, 1989. So I was 15. Yes, I was 15. I'd have been 16 later that year. That Saturday, it was a Saturday, and my grandpa died that day, and that was the first sort of death I had experienced in our family of a person. He loved his boxing, and he loved listening to the radio. And I can remember that Saturday night into Sunday morning, waking up, having probably not had that much sleep through being so upset, and I was very close to him, and listening to the Bruno Tyson fight on the radio. Sort of with tears in my eyes, really, because I knew that he'd have probably listened to it with me had he not sadly died. So, yeah, that for me actually is the power of the medium, the power of radio more than any other medium, more than television, miles more than television, is that radio has the ability to have that one-on-one connection with you, and can be a, and we're getting texts and tweets about it at the moment. It can be a comfort, it can be a friend, it can be a celebration. It is often there with you at both the good and the bad times.
Yeah, because who knows where the media is going long term in all sorts of broad ways, but you would be hopeful radio might just about hang in there, because I mean, you think of football commentary, hasn't changed very much in about 60 years. There is a beautiful simplicity to it. And the adaptability you mentioned there, I remember listening to your piece before the Manchester United Ajax game on the back of the bombings. Fantastic intro. Yeah. You know, you love Manchester, you're from Manchester. Yeah. The night of the bombings, the radio geek in me, when I was in bed that night, I was listening to Five Live and people calling in with their stories, what they had seen, where they were. Yeah. The most phenomenal night of radio. And it still has that going for it in a way that even TV doesn't.
No, absolutely, because it is simply a phone call and you are through, and it is that conversation, and you don't have to have that worry about getting the right graphic up or what you might show at the same time as you're listening to someone on the phone. And that, whilst actually visually does work to a certain extent, it also can overcomplicate things. So you've got a news presenter in the studio talking to someone on the phone, but you're also watching, a bit like we're doing now, you've got a split screen, you're sort of watching what's going on, you've got the graphics everywhere. Whereas if it is just you sitting there or lying in bed, you are listening to a one-on-one conversation between a presenter and, you know, somebody who'd experienced the arena attack and nothing else. And that is incredibly personal and incredibly haunting at the same time. And your attention is not distracted by anything else. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that intro, because I mean, it's a small thing in actually what happened, but that's an example of, I don't think I've ever been as nervous on air before delivering that, because I knew because I'm a Mancunian and because I'm a known Mancunian that I wanted to say something, but I didn't want to be saying something for the sake of saying something. I also knew how difficult it was for United fans and Manchester, and United and City had done something together, which was beautiful around that time. And there were just so many things that were going through my head that I knew that I wanted to say to me, I had to say something, and then I had to make sure that I delivered it in the right tone, at the right pace, to then still give the commentators enough time to actually build up to the game. So that there is an example of when you are very nervous before doing something.
Yeah. Match of the day is a really interesting exercise in trying to manage the clock and also have some kind of interesting conversation, and I always feel you do a really good job of that, to be honest, because there are certain points you have to hit. There has to be a degree of pre-rehearsed, you do this, I'll do that about it.
Yeah.
And it strikes me from afar, the real skill is, you're probably, as each pundit is talking, almost waiting, is there an interesting tangent in what you're saying now?
Yes.
Is it now? And the skill in TV more than radio is really... do I gamble on that tangent? That sounds good. I think there could be something there, but then I'm going to have to drop what we're planning on in 2 minutes. And sometimes it's an open goal of a tangent.
Yeah.
And other times you just have to trust your instinct. That is the really interesting area you get into as a broadcaster when you're juggling all those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if you've got three games, for example, on a Sunday, it's very easy to go off on a tangent on the first one, because you know you've got a bit of a buffer coming up later on and hopefully you can scramble some of the time back. It also depends who your pundits are. It depends how much you have talked, rehearsed through analysis in the build-ups going on air, and there is quite a long process of going through everything. But equally, with someone like Alan, for example, or Ian, who have done it for a very long time and are experienced enough, I will maybe say, oh, if you do that off the back of it, I'm going to ask you something, but I won't say what I'm going to, ask you.
Yeah.
And then it's more, natural, and they have to have a think about it and so on and so okay. forth. If you're with a newer pundit, you are guiding them through it a bit more, and you might have helped a lot more in the process of the analysis and go, okay, right, well, if you're going to analyze the back three, at the end of that analysis, you said something when we were in the edit and practicing, you said something about one of the wing backs. So I'll probably pick up on that afterwards if you just want to have a think about what the wing back would do. Then at the same time, you just have, you know, if you have a pundit who is liable to say something ridiculous every now and then, I will often say to them, look, if you do say something ridiculous, I will probably pick up on that just to get you to reiterate it. Otherwise, you're going to get hammered. So if you really believe it, you'll back it up. But if not, you'll go, oh, all right, maybe I went a little bit overboard there and so on and so forth, which gives them a little bit of a get out and a safety cushion, really.
Yeah, it's a lot of balls to juggle. Is it enjoyable, or is it a kind? I mean, it must be a surreal thing when the Match of the Day music plays.
No, it's amazing. It's massively enjoyable. I mean, first of all, whatever people think about pundits, and they get, you know, it amuses me how much stick a lot of pundits get, but they've played the game at the highest level.
Sure.
So to sit and watch. To sit and watch football with them and then tell me what they would do in a certain situation is still a privilege. And as I've said several
times...
Often more interesting than the game. Often more interesting than the game. And you are sitting there, and Kevin Kilbane will be able to back this story up. You've got so many other... You've got other screens going on as well as the games. Now, often there isn't much else going on, right? But there might be a bit of cricket going on, and so you can keep an eye on that for other things. And I can remember doing one, Ruud Gullit and Kevin, and one game finishing, and the hurling, I think, may have been on one of the other Sky channels. So Kevin explaining hurling to Ruud Gullit is an incredibly surreal moment for me. But doing anything with Ruud, I think if you'd have said to the 15-year-old me who watched Euro 88 and thought, my God, this is the best team I've ever seen, that I would be watching Premier League football with Ruud Gullit and talking about it with him, I'd have never have believed them. No, so sure. I never ever forget that. And the music's an interesting one because now you're so used to it, it's fine. You go and do one of those FA Cup draws and people hear it and the buzz that goes around the room when the music starts, or you get a new pundit and you can see them. You can see the new pundit if they are nervous. That music starts because it's live and they grip the side of their chairs when that music starts. It has an amazing effect on people.
I presume Ruud Gullit quickly acknowledged that hurling was indeed the game of the gods, the greatest game
he had ever seen. I mean, he it was that. There was one conversation about hurling and one on dressage with Ruud. I mean, both of them slightly surreal, I'll be honest with you.
Abuse is a big part of it. You mentioned the abuse pundits get. I know from talking to Kevin, like you do an episode of Match of the Day, you check your tweets at your peril. It's incredible, the culture. With football in particular, like we do lots here, you get plenty of criticism, justified or otherwise. We did a big thing with Gary Neville and Roy Keane a while back. Honestly, it was an insight into more of what's going on, maybe your side of the pond than here. It's not as vitriolic here, but it was a genuine insight into. It's kind of crazy. It's unhinged, mad
it
stuff,
is.
And the volume of it is incredible.
And I don't quite know how we've. I don't quite know how we've got into that situation, really. It just escalates. And I find it really... one of the interesting things is when I have either someone who's connected to Rangers or Celtic and they do a show and then I see the stuff that comes in there and I'm like, wow. Mm. I mean, good grief. I mean, I never... that is where it really does blow me away sometimes with some of the stuff that comes in both ways, depending on who I've got, depending on who they've played for. But what I found really odd at the moment with is there doesn't quite often, even where the football community should be all together, there is still club loyalty that rises above it. So I'll give you a good example is empty seats, right? Empty seats. My God, the debate and argument over who's loyal and who's this and why they've got, you know, where they've got empty seats or they've got empty seats or whatever. Surely all football fans should be going, the reason you've got empty seats is because ticket prices are A, too expensive, and B, TV, all TV companies, you know, I know Sky, BT, but we do the FA Cup and schedule some ridiculous times for games as well. Mm. And it is complex, but we still schedule some ridiculous times, right? TV companies take the mick and the clubs take the mick with the pricing. So we should all be together as football fans going, this isn't on. If it was more reasonably priced and, you know, more convenient and public transport was better and so on and so on, grounds would be full. It's not about who's more loyal. Surely we ought to all pull together.
This is potentially tricky for you, right? So you can plead the fifth a little bit because no one wants to be lured into having a go at their employers. But I did want to talk to you about where you think broadcasting is going. And I'm not as in touch with this as somebody in the UK, but I did see Mark Pugac depart at Five Live, not of his own decision. Someone like Cornelius Lycett, a very famous, brilliant voice. Mm. And the critical pieces I read seem to suggest this is, in effect, the BBC trying to reach out to the youth and get them into the station, and that's how they're maneuvering things. Whether that's the case or not, I don't know. What I do know, though, is regardless of what age you are, whether you're 20 or whether you're 60, as someone like Cornelius Lycett, the expertise, the quality of broadcasting, for me, that's not an age issue.
No.
I mean, I don't think 15-year-olds, when David Attenborough comes out of Glastonbury, thinks, God, he's old though. Why would I care what he said?
No.
And I'm not sure about the policy. So where are we going here in terms of media and how we pitch?
Well, I don't know really. And you know, I've got a 17-year-old boy. I've got a 12-year-old and a 6-year-old girl. And I can judge quite a lot. Not that they're right about everything, but I can judge quite a lot about how they experience media, broadcasting, whatever it may be. My view has always been people progress through the BBC as listeners or viewers at their own rate. Now, there might be somebody in the department at the BBC telling me, oh, well, the stats are showing that they're not doing that anymore and this, that and the other. But yeah. So to you, I came to Radio 1 at 15 or whatever it may be, and then you progress and I eventually stopped working at Radio 1. I might listen to Radio 2 a little bit. I'll go to Five Live for football comment, whatever it may be. Mm. Now, but if I wanted a bit of a laugh, you know, in my 20s and didn't want as, you know, wanted football entertainment, then I'd watch Soccer AM. Now, my personal feeling is that there is a place for people know where they can go to get certain types of content. I think with some of the things that have been going on, look, it's not for me to say. I think the interesting thing with Cornelius, who is a fantastic broadcaster, is actually how we sell that sport more. And I think this is more of an interesting debate going forward is horse racing, golf, rugby league, any sport that isn't the Premier League, basically, how are they going to get as much coverage across a lot of media as possible? You know, I think ITV and the racing, whoever controls the racing rights are having a debate at the moment about whether the racing stays on ITV. Why would it not stay on ITV? But it's about how to cover all these different sports in this shadow of the Premier League behemoth. My personal view is BBC Sport and Five Live Sport have to be more than just the Premier League. And we have to be, you know, whilst that is the number one and drives a lot of listeners and viewers and so on and so forth, we have a responsibility to sell and make other sports popular or interesting. But those sports have a responsibility, I think, to also work with us and other broadcasters to help us in that situation. And without, you know, patting myself on the back, you know, the NFL have actually worked quite hard with us to make sure we grow the NFL. And right. and we have managed to grow the interest over here, partly through OC and Jason being sensational, but partly through the access and the material they give us. So, and also that show has a massive young audience. Well, I'm 46.
Yeah.
OC's Jason's 40 and OC's late 30s or something like that. It's not like we're 22 and on YouTube all the time. Mm. So you can bring a young audience without, in my view, without, I hate the word, well, without changing how you are.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
No, total sense. And it's, you know, so much of what we instinctively think is the case, i.e., you know, people have short attention spans. If you look at the last couple of years, as the bandwidth that the internet provides us with has expanded, people like 10-part, 2-hour true crime podcasts.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
want 3-hour Joe Rogan interviews. People have attention spans. But 10 years ago, there was no way of proving that.
No. And that's absolutely it. And look, you know, if you do long form and it brings in a whole new audience, great. If you do long form and it brings in your traditional audience, great. It's not all about trying to, or for me, it certainly is not all about just trying to find a young audience. The way I try and do sport, and I've always believed this, is I look at Test Match Special, which probably has all Sky's cricket coverage. They're the two. I've always said this, that if we're all sat at home as a family of five and have the cricket on, it can appeal to those of us in our family who love cricket and those that have a passing interest in it or no interest in it, because there's a bit of fun with Bumble or whatever. There's the really good analysis with Avers and NASA, and everything that was brought together by David Gower or Wardy or whatever, and there's something for everybody in it.
Mm.
And that's the same with TMS. If you're on a 4-hour car journey, you want to know you get the cricket, you want to get the serious stuff, but you've got to have a bit of fun with it. Otherwise, you won't keep a car journey together because people will want the music on or this, that, and the other. That's how I think, passionately believe sport should be. You don't patronise the people who love it and are experts, but you try and make it accessible to anybody who might be passing by and listening and watching.
Who's your favourite pundit?
Who's my favourite pundit? like who I don't work with. I think Atherton and NASA on Sky's cricket are absolutely sensational, and I think Ian Ward is the best presenter out there for analysis masterclasses. I think he is second to none in what he definitely nails that. If you're a learning cricket, this will help you.
Mm.
If you're a connoisseur of cricket, this will just be really, really good insight. So, you know, I can just sit and watch guys cricket for hours and hours and hours.
You've dodged that beautifully, I have to say. Well done. What about a presenter that you really rate, sports presenter or otherwise, but I guess sports presenter, even two or three that you look at and think, yeah, top of their craft?
I think I mentioned Ian Ward.
Yeah.
I think Ed Chamberlain and the way he does the racing, I think, which is a very, very difficult sport to, because that is just, I mean, if you're doing a big event like Cheltenham or the National, whatever, it is chaotic. I mean, there are just people and animals and whatever everywhere. And he exudes calm, does Ed. And also, that is a very difficult, he's going back to what we were saying, that is a very difficult sport to try and bring the sort of once a year amateur in and keep the connoisseurs happy. And I'm biased because I work with her a lot. But Kelly Cates is head and shoulders the best football presenter out there. Because she doesn't take it too seriously, and she knows it's fun as well.
Mm.
But can also do but when it has to be serious, it is serious. So So Kelly, Ed, and Ian Ward for me. I'm sure there are others that I've missed, but they're the three for me.
People scoff when they get asked this question because it's a terrible question. I wouldn't know how to answer it, but maybe you've given it some thought. Where would you like to be in 10 years? What would you like to be doing, still doing, or otherwise?
I don't know, really, to be honest with you. I'm doing a master's at the moment at Manchester Met University in sporting directorship. So I'm learning more about running sports and clubs and that kind of thing. And that I find really, really interesting. And has really sort of tested my brain and got those juices flowing. So that's something that really, really interests me, and where that might go, I've no idea. And aside from that, I haven't massively thought about it. But as long as I can still do radio in some capacity, I think I'll be happy.
Okay, so it's radio over TV as the love.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, God, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah, yeah.
And then take Ed Woodward's job in an ideal world.
No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I could work for the owners, to be honest with you, on that one, to put it diplomatically.
Is that right? Because you're a United fan, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I have to say, at the moment, when you're looking at I was going to say proud of what your club is doing, but actually just grateful that they're doing the right thing, and they appear to be doing the right thing in this current crowd. They actually, you know, the players have, as I understand it, have put a fund together through Harry Maguire coordinating that. You know, they seem to be treating their staff properly during this time. So I'm grateful for that. All the other problems at United sort of seem slightly insignificant in the current climate. So I'm just happy that they're doing what to me appears to be the right thing at the moment.
Yeah, well, accepting that they are not serious problems in the current climate. Obviously, you're in Manchester. You probably have lots of family and friends who support Manchester United. The Glazers thing, the leveraged buyout, the sums of money taken out of the club, even though commercially it's still doing very well, but the sums of money which have gone stateside, still went stateside. Is that still like a real fraught, raw issue for people? Like, you see the green and yellow scarves at times, the Newton Heath days, or is there a general kind of, let's just get on with it at this stage, acceptance?
I'm not sure it's talked about all the time, to be honest with you. I think those of us of a certain age are probably more bothered about it than, you know, a 14-year-old who's on their way to the game. And I think, you know, for those of us that look at how the club is run, the money that they take out of it, and the, you know, interest payments and so on and so forth, on top of some of the quite frankly ridiculous commercial deals with, you know, the pillow company in, you know, Kenya or wherever it is, and noodles in, you know, Malaysia.
A lot of sponsors.
Yeah, a lot of sponsors. I mean, and that, you know, yes, it's a commercial world, but, you know, I actually look at it from the football side of it, and actually how much commercial work do the players have to do for all these deals coming in, and what is that taking them away from when it comes to actually, you know, the football side of things. So there are still, I think, lots and lots of concerns from a lot of fans. I don't think it's an everyday subject of conversation. I think the more everyday topic of conversation is the fact that when it comes to bringing players in, or even giving players contracts, or even selling players, that the people who are doing that don't really appear to have a great deal of football knowledge. I think that's where the greater sort of regular conversation is.
I've no doubt. Well, listen, thanks so much for your time. I certainly hope that in November you're at the Masters. I hope you're back on Match of the Day 2 very soon. Jeez, I certainly hope the world is not a place where you can be at the Super Bowl again come next year. But I mean,
so do I. Knows.
These are incredible times. It's surreal at the moment.
It really is. And you look at, you know, I saw today actually was the day I think I was meant to be flying. Today was the day I was meant to be flying to the Masters. You know, and I saw yesterday and they put it in November, and you just look at it and think, I don't know, I'm not sure. Is that feasible? Is it not? And just any kind of crowd at a sporting event, I wonder just how weird that is going to feel for the first time. Mm. Because it still feels like it's going to be a long way off, really. You know, if anything comes back, it's going to be behind closed doors, as I see it.
Yeah.
So that first sporting event that you go and do, which has got people at it, I think will feel very odd.
Yeah, I was saying that to someone last night. I think the behavioral economics of this whole thing, even when they loosen restrictions, will be fascinating. I have no intention of going to a crowded pub for a long time.
No.
I think really, until maybe in a year's time, and it'll be a great day. I said on the show a few weeks ago, you know, on the news ticker on Sky News or BBC equally available. but when the ticker comes up and says vaccine found, I don't think it will fully be until post that date that everybody is totally comfortable to just revert to normal.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there'll always be that sort of... suspicion's a bit of a strong word, isn't it? But wariness, wariness of even shaking hands with someone, which is ridiculous because you know, I presented from Cheltenham on Gold Cup Day, and we were still shaking hands. We were meant to be doing this and this and whatever, but people were still shaking hands, and
because that was a huge controversy over here, actually. I didn't get the impression you guys were in the same space, you know. Maybe your government.
We weren't, definitely not. And I drove there on that Friday. Well, I went there on a jolly on the Tuesday, and then drove there on the Friday to present Five Live for Gold Cup. It felt very, and even from Tuesday to Friday, it had gone. I tell you why, because Arteta had tested positive on the Thursday. So football had gone on the Thursday. And so arriving on the Friday, I'm thinking, this is very weird. This is very odd. I'm not sure we should be here. And yet, once it starts, and once the racing starts, and once you're talking to people, it then starts to feel a bit more normal, I suppose. And you sort of forget about it for a bit. But now... Wow. I do find it very odd that we were even allowed to do it.
Yeah, no, it was real angry here because there were 15,000 Irish who came back and scattered to the four corners. And I don't know, there's no way of doing it, but you wouldn't like to see the numbers who came home directly affected and were indirectly affected all over the UK and Ireland, because Cheltenham officials can rest assured they'll be answering questions about this in about a year's time in a big way.
Yeah. Well, I think there'll be two. I think there'll be that. And how on earth Liverpool against Atletico Madrid went ahead with away fans in it at Anfield on the Was that the Wednesday?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, the memory of Jurgen Klopp telling people to put their effing hands away.
Yeah. So that was the Wednesday, and how that was. They're the two that I think the historians will look back on and go, how on earth did you let that happen?
Yeah, they're saying Atalanta, Valencia in
was
a huge issue as well. Anyway, listen, that's all for another day. Wish you well. Thanks so much for doing this. Much appreciated.
No problem.
Again in a year or something when the world is normal.
Yeah, anytime. Stay in touch. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
With guilt like your eyes.